98 FM.
She's out of reach and out of sight. When she walks by, she...
It's just coming out listening to Michelle Ward with Eat My Brunch. Now, I should be joined on the line by Tom McGuinness. Are you there, Tom?
I'm here.
Hello, Tom. Now, I'm delighted to be joined by Tom McGuinness of Manfred Mann, who boasts such hits as the iconic 54321, Ain't No, Not My Baby, A Pretty Flamingo, which we've just played, and Come Tomorrow, and so many more. Now, Tom will be joining original members Paul Jones, Mike Hugg, along with Rob Townsend, Marcus Cliff, and Simon Curry as the exciting new lineup of the Manfred. So, good morning to you.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm fine. I woke up very late this morning.
I'm not sure I'm awake yet.
No, it is a little bit early. Now, before we talk about the up-and-coming tour, when did you get your first guitar and what made you want to learn?
Well, I got my first guitar in about 1956, I think it was. It was a Spanish guitar. I have no doubt what made me want to learn the guitar was seeing Lonnie Donegan, or rather hearing him on the radio.
Yeah.
Because we didn't have a television in those days. That made me want to pick up the guitar. And it wasn't just me, you know, it was Hilton Valentine in The Animals, and it was George Harrison in The Beatles, and Eric Clapton, and a whole generation of us picked up the guitar because of Lonnie Donegan. And then we soon realized that if you amplified that guitar, you could play rock and roll on it. So...
Because it was an exciting time. Now, you started your career in a band with another 18-year-old. You mentioned him just then, Eric Clapton, in a band called The Roosters.
Yeah, I'd actually been playing before that. I'd been playing in various bands around South London in pubs. But I met Eric. I'd actually gone for an audition at another pub, and Eric was there with my then girlfriend, now my wife, who was an art student with Eric.
Oh, right.
And I came off stage after this audition where I turned the job down. Funnily enough, Ray Davis took the job the next week that I'd turned down. Davis of the Kinks.
Yeah.
But I came off stage and she said, "Oh well, this is Eric. He loves the blues." So we got a little band together, and that was mid 1963. Lasted about 6 months. It didn't so much end as peter out. Suddenly we didn't have another date in the book, and you know, that was it really.
The
music, what happened to him after?
Yeah, I don't know, I've never heard of him. That's Eric Clapton we're talking about. Now, the music scene in the 60s, it was a real explosion and a really exciting time for new music, especially in the UK. What was it like to actually live in that era? Because we can look back and it was just an explosion.
It was. At the time, you didn't realize how lucky we were, you know. I mean, basically, there was so many musicians out there wanting to play. There were lots of venues to play at. Mm. You know, it was really pretty easy to get gigs if you had the necessary get up and go. And there was a booming economy, really. You know, there was very little unemployment. You could always try something, and if it didn't work out, you could take a job for sort of 3 months and go back and try something else. So it was a fantastic time, and there was just a coming together of things. You know, we'd all grown up with rock and roll, and we started making a sort of British version of it.
Yeah.
And when I started out, I wanted to play rhythm and blues. I wanted to play the music of Chicago bluesmen circa 1955. And so it turned out did other people, like Eric Clapton or the Stones or Spencer Davis and his band up there in Birmingham, or the Animals in Newcastle. There was a whole lot of us growing up, plus the whole Liverpool thing was happening with the Beatles and all the other good musicians coming out of there. And it was It was also a time when the record business suddenly saw that they could, instead of just releasing American records that had been hits already, or making cover versions of American records with English artists, they suddenly saw there was this homegrown talent, which was, a money-making opportunity for them.
And how did you guys all get together in Manfred Mann? Where did it actually start from?
Well, they'd been going for a year when I joined. They decided that their bass player wasn't right for them, and they got me in. I switched from guitar to playing bass with them. They got together as a result of Manfred, the keyboard player, and Mike Hugg, who was then our drummer, but is now our keyboard player. They were at a Butlins holiday camp doing a summer season, playing sort of jazz for the punters. There was a whole R&B thing, rhythm and blues thing, beginning to happen, particularly in London, with bands like The Stones and Alexis Corner and Graham Bond. And they thought, well, it's not jazz, which is what they wanted to do, but we could make a living out of this. It's not too far from what we want to do. And they got together, first of all, another whole load of jazz musicians they knew, and looked for a singer, and they found Paul Jones, who was the only singer who turned up for the audition, which is how he got the job. And in fact, the band was divided as to whether they should take him, so they decided to take him for the time being.
Yep.
And here we are 51 years later.
Wow. now,
it's
Manfred...
only temporary.
Yeah. Manfred... Sorry, go on.
I came in about a year later. They'd built up a big reputation around the clubs of London and the south of England. And they got a record deal, and I joined, and about a month later they had the first hit, which was, we had our first hit, which was the theme tune of a TV show called Ready, Steady, Go, and the hit was
5-4-3-2, yeah. 2-1. I was just going to mention that, but I was also going to say, it's interesting that you were, in today's kind of pop world, I think, people form bands and they think you're going to go out. It's all the groundwork. If you're a musician, most people have been sort of gigging for years, and you have to do your pubs and your clubs and your holiday camps. That's where you learn your craft, isn't it?
Well, it is, but, some people can suddenly burst out of nowhere.
Yep.
They've been doing it in their front room, and, I think that's also always been the case. You know, there are singer-songwriter types who've always managed to burst through without much groundwork going on. But I think doing a bit of groundwork really helps, because you've sort of got... You've built up a certain expertise, a natural born talent needs to be exposed to the public, and you figure out what works, what doesn't work. There's nothing like playing live, to be honest.
Yeah. You mentioned 5-4-3-2-1, which was written for the TV music show of the day, which was Ready, Steady, Go. That, again, was a groundbreaking music show, because there's been nothing like it on TV before that.
No, it was... I think to say there was nothing like it. There had been a very rock and roll-y show called Oh Boy, produced by a guy called Jack Good, which was perhaps more theatrical than Ready, Steady, Go. But it still had quite a... you felt it was being done on the run, the camera movements, the way it was shot. It was pretty exciting. Ready, Steady, Go carried on from that tradition, I think, but made it a little more relaxed, a little less theatrical, a little more like being in a club rather than watching a theatrical show. And it just touched a nerve, because it, as well as what was currently happening in England, there were a lot of American artists who we really admired who were starting to come over, people like Benny King and also John Lee Hooker, people like that. And they were appearing on national television in a primetime slot alongside bands like us and The Who and The Animals and The Stones and whatever. It was a great program. And of course things like The Tube and that have all learnt lessons from Ready, Steady, Go.
Yeah.
And later with Jules, they all owe a debt to that. But Ready, Steady, Go equally owes a debt back to Jack Good and his TV productions.
Now, Manfred Mann had their first hit with Do Wah Diddy Diddy, which went to the top of the US charts. So what was it like going over to America with that being at the top of the charts in the US?
It was it seemed a bit like Coles to Newcastle in some ways. You know, all our influences had been American up until then.
Mm.
We were sort of reworking American music. We were undoubtedly making something uniquely sort of British out of it, but we owed so much to them, we thought it was really weird that... You know, all our films, all our popular culture was coming from America up until the 60s, when suddenly we started exporting back to America. And it seems strange, and, you know, to arrive in America, and there are, it was very different. It was very prosperous, though, of course, like all countries, it had its pockets of poverty that we also saw.
Mm.
But it was, you know, there was a stretch limousine to collect us from the airport. We'd never seen a stretch limousine. Now you see them every weekend night in all the big cities.
Mm.
You know, ferrying hen parties around, but we'd never seen one. And you turn the radio on, and there are sort of 30 radio stations.
Mm.
Well, we only had two in the whole of England.
Yeah.
So very different. You know, the portions of food. I can remember thinking, I can't eat all this. you know, gigantic portions. Fresh pineapple in December. We've never seen such a thing.
Yeah.
So it was, you know, consumer paradise, if that's what you want.
your second British number one was Pretty Flamingo, which I kicked off the interview with. And there's a very famous singer-guitarist who used to play that quite a bit. Do you know who it is?
The only person I know who does Pretty Flamingo is... Actually, Elvis Costello has done it.
Yep.
But Bruce Springsteen...
That's it, yep.
...does a great version of it. He was a big admirer, well, he is, of Paul Jones and his singing. I've got a CD somewhere that someone burnt me from concerts in America of Bruce Springsteen doing Doo-Wah-Diddy-Diddy, Pretty Flamingo and Shalala, which
were
hits that we'd had.
Yeah, that must be amazing.
Yeah.
And a great compliment to have people covering your tunes. Well, you know they cover your tunes all over the place, but to have Bruce Springsteen do it must have just been amazing.
Yeah. I went to see Springsteen when he first came over, when he was at Hammersmith Odeon in 1975, I think it was. And he did two nights there, and I saw the first night. And the second night, he did Pretty Flamingo, so I'd like to have been there the second night to see him do that.
Yeah.
That would have been good.
Now,
I have to tell you, this line is really breaking up. From your end, I can hardly hear what you're saying.
Oh, I've normally got such a boom. Is that better? I've got such a booming voice. I might
That's
be talking
better.
Really quiet.
That's better. It's not brilliant, but it's better.
All right. at the end of the 60s, the band ended and you all went your separate ways and you did McGuinness Flint.
Yes. Like most of the best things in life, it sort of happened by chance. Huey Flint, fine drummer who'd been with John Mayall and Blues Breakers and Georgie Fame and all sorts of people. He was a neighbour of mine. In fact, we were both with... I was married to one woman and he was going out with her sister at the time. So we used to just hang out together and we thought it'd be nice to get a band together. And we were really lucky. We hooked up with Gallagher and Lyle, Benny Gallagher and Graham Lyle.
Yep.
And they were the songwriting heart of the band. And... we ended up being called McGuinness Flint. We were never going to call it that, but we got to the point where we got a record deal to be signed and they wanted to know what the band was called.
Mm.
And it was actually Gallagher and Lyle who said, well, let's call it McGuinness Flint because you two got the band together. So,
yeah,
we were, you know, I was kind of surprised because having had, I think it was 15, 16 hits with Manfred Mann, I just assumed that was it.
Mm.
And you don't get a second bite, but luckily I did, yeah, McGuinness Flint. It was a good band. It was too short-lived. We just made two albums, and then Benny and Graham decided they wanted to go off and, you know, just pursue a life as a duo.
Yeah.
But it was fun while it lasted.
You started in the blues band with Paul Jones in 1979.
Yes, we just celebrate in April. It'll be 25 years since we did our first gig. Again, pure chance. Paul rang me up and said, do you fancy doing a couple of gigs in a pub?
Mm.
He was doing a lot of theatre work at the time, and he had Sundays off. So I said, happy to do that, Paul. But I mean, at the time, I was doing a lot of songwriting, producing other people's stuff like that, stuff in the back room, and I was really enjoying it. And I can remember Paul said, do you want to do a couple of gigs in the pub? And I said, yes, Paul, as long as it's just a couple of gigs.
Yeah.
Because I really don't want to be driving up and down motorways or anything like that. He said, no, no, it's just a couple of gigs. Now, here we are, it must be 2,000 gigs later.
Yeah.
And, you know, we're still doing about 60 a year with the blues band.
That's excellent.
But again, it wasn't planned.
Mm.
You know, it sort of happened, and, you know, we had a couple of hit albums, and we're still recording new albums every few years. It goes on. I mean, it's all about playing live music.
Mm. I was going to ask you just about actually how you got back together with the Manfreds, you know, to form the Manfreds. But before that, do you still, I mean, getting up on stage as a musician is fantastic. What is the best thing for you about being a musician?
Playing live.
Yeah, and you still get a buzz every time you're up on stage.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
In fact, I don't even have to be on stage. If I go and play with a couple of friends in a local pub,
yeah,
I get a buzz out of that. There's a thing about making live music with other people and communicating it to an audience. It's fantastic. Making records is lovely, but it's a technical process.
Mm.
This is much more of an emotional thing. I mean, I can't walk past live music.
Yeah.
You know, if there's a brass band playing in a pavilion, I'll go and watch it. There's something wonderful about people making music together. Or a choir singing.
Mm.
You know? And I've got grandchildren now. I go to the local village primary school where I live. They've got a choir and an orchestra. Well, you know, the orchestra consists of a violin, a saxophone, 14 recorders, someone playing percussion, and, you know, it's a real hodgepodge. But, you know, just hearing them play God Rest You Merry Gentlemen or something like that. It's wonderful to see and hear people making music together, and I love doing it.
How did you get back together to form the Manfreds?
Again, we didn't set out to reform the Manfreds. We all got together to have a sort of party for my 50th birthday.
Mm.
And we made it into a gig as well as a party. There were like sort of 300 guests and 1,000 paying customers.
Yeah.
The blues band played, McGinnis Flint stroke Gallagher and Lyles played, and the Manfreds played, and we all got back together for that night. It was just a one night thing.
Mm.
But the phone started ringing.
Mm.
And our old record company got in touch and said, we're putting out a Manfred Mann greatest hits package, will you do a few gigs to promote that? And we did, and that led on to, you know, we went to America on a sort of British invasion tour with Jerry and the Pacemakers and Herman and people, and it just sort of built. But it's not a full-time thing.
Mm.
You know, we do about 60 gigs a year with the Manfreds, 60 with the blues band.
Yeah.
Still, I mean, you know, it's a third of the year gone.
I think any musician would be happy with 60 gigs a year.
But, you know, it's not like work.
No, it's not like being in an office, that's for sure.
Being in a coal mine or being a nurse.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, your audience today, what's your audience like? Is it made up from a real mixture of ages? And do you recognise any of the followers from the original days of the band?
I don't recognise anyone in the audience, generally. I mean, people do come up and say, I haven't seen you since, you know, North Pier Blackpool in 1964.
Yeah.
To which our reply usually is, you should get out more. But the audience is predominantly between about 55 and 75.
Yeah.
But you do see three generations of a family there. And there are young people out there who are sort of 60s obsessed.
Yeah.
Who wear the clothes and love the music. In fact, we went to Tokyo recently and did some shows over there with the Manfreds. And the audience were predominantly in their 20s and 30s.
Mm.
And they were totally into dressing 60s. And it was a strange experience because literally the women screamed and cried when we played the big hit.
Yeah.
It was like being back in 1964. Strange experience.
What's
fun. I mean, it was so touching to find that these young people from a completely different culture knew everything we'd done and were so moved by it.
Mm. What song throughout your career are you most proud of?
Pr- proud is the wrong word, honestly, because, you know, what we do is like, it has a longer, slightly longer shelf life than yesterday's newspaper, but in the great scheme of things, giving pleasure to people is a lovely thing to do, but, you know, pride, you know, who's going to remember do-wah-diddy-diddy? You know, it's a bit of fluff as far as history's concerned. I have certain favourite records of Manfred Mann. My favourite is If You Gotta Go, Go Now. It was sort of, it's hard to believe when you hear what sort of happens in lyrics with hip-hop and rap and all that. But If You Gotta Go was actually banned in America as being too suggestive. Got to number two here.
Yeah.
I always think of it as like, you know, it's a Bob Dylan song, but it's cheeky like those George Formby songs.
Yeah.
But no, American stations wouldn't play it because it was so suggestive.
Now, you're going to be playing on Friday the 7th at the Broadway Theatre in Barking. That's the nearest one to where we are.
It's
on 0207 8507 5607. We will put all the details up on the website. You can obviously find out more, all the W's, themanfreds.com. And I just have to say, Pam and Lynn Bruce, who are listening out there, and they've been to loads of your gigs over the years, and they've been fans since when you started, they contacted me to say hi to you, Tom, and thank you for the music, and they can't wait to see you at Horsham on the 3rd of April.
Oh, brilliant. Well, great. I mean, where would we be without the audience, you know? We'd look pretty stupid on a stage with no one in the room, wouldn't we?
Well, I think sometimes, isn't it worse playing to a few people? Would you prefer playing to big crowds or small crowds, or you just like playing, don't you?
I just like playing.
Yeah.
You know, you can walk out, I mean, to be honest, how many have I played to? Well, you know, I've done the main stage at Glastonbury, I've done the San Siro Stadium in Milan, I've done the Colosseum in Verona, and yet playing to, you know, 300 people in Horsham or Barking or wherever, it's another buzz. There's an intimacy about smaller clubs and theatres that I like, and it's just the rapport with the audience that makes it all... No, I won't say it makes it all worthwhile. What makes it all worthwhile is making good music with people you like and respect and get on with. That's the first thing. But then having an audience that responds to you and gives you encouragement and urges you on. Because they do it in sort of subtle ways. It's not just a matter of cheering. It's, you know, it's that moment when you're playing something quiet and you could hear a pin drop.
Yeah.
You know, the audience is paying attention. But when an audience cheers and... You know, people get up and dance in the aisles at theatres. What a great moment.
Well, thank you ever so much. It's been lovely to talk to you, Tom. Hopefully my voice is a bit louder. A bit louder now. So don't forget, you can go and see the Manfreds on Friday the 7th at the Broadway Theatre in Barking. That's the nearest one to us. But if you go to the website, all the W's, themanfreds.com, you can find all the dates for all over the country. So thanks very much, Tom. Have a really successful tour. I know you still love doing music, which is, you can hear it when you're talking to me on the phone. But thank you very much for joining us today. And we're going to finish on 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Excellent. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Have a great day. Thanks, Tom. Thank you. Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Right, here we go. Here is Manfred Mann with 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Friends.